Welcome to Post-Traumatic Thriving, where we explore life's toughest issues along with the art, science, and stories of resilience. Please be advised that our guests share their raw stories of addiction, abuse, crime, and tragedy, along with tips to survive and thrive. And now, here is our host, Dr. Randall Bell.
Welcome back to Post-Traumatic Thriving. I am Dr. Randall Bell. I am here with the author of Home is Within You, which is releasing soon. Nadia Davis is in the house. Welcome back, Nadia.
Hello. Thank you. We made it through.
We made it through the trauma stage, kind of. We're going to revisit some additional layers of trauma, but you're in the survival stage. In the last episode, if you didn't listen, I suggest backing up and start with the beginning of Nadia's story, because her childhood is really important to getting the whole thing. And there's little nuggets. Well, I shouldn't say that. Big nuggets of wisdom throughout the whole episode. But where we left off is that you grew up here in Southern California. Your dad started out as a farm worker and then worked his way into being a very prominent attorney who literally changed the landscape of law, and sadly passed away in his 50s playing basketball. He was a larger than life person. You got into UCLA, you got into law school, and you had graduated from law school, and then had a big case going on, very high profile, sounds like. Then you were tragically in a car wreck, and you were in the hospital with lots of broken bones. And this sounds to me like it was a pivotal thing, because you had a near-death experience. So you want to talk more about that, and where do you want to kind of go from that recovery in the hospital and that whole experience?
The near-death experience held the answers to life. What I saw and what broader picture of what this physical life is. And so following that, when you're, you know, waking up and you're 2 months after a near-death experience and you're in your body and you're, you know, IV to morphine and barely neurologically as well as just mentally kind of going, oh my God, what happened to me? I didn't understand what happened to me in those first moments, yet I saw a little beanie baby that Arthur Carmona, the kid that I was representing that was wrongfully convicted, had sent to me. And that, as well as posters from the community, and it really was the community's belief in me and the causes that I was fighting for, and that sense of identity and purpose and worth that got me to start to try and move my body again. And so slowly but surely, I, you know, got my foot down, got it onto the sliding board, and went through what some may be familiar with is the process of physical rehabilitation and recovery. My will to continue fighting for justice and hope and light in this world was so strong, I went home in the wheelchair. I barely had a weight-bearing status, and so I went back to my school board meetings. I was on the school board in Santa Ana, the same school district that my father had sued for discrimination, decades before that, and received numerous awards, J.F. Kennedy Jr. Public Service Award, all kinds of different awards prior to that. After that, it was, okay. Our Nadia is back. Arthur was still in jail. And I got a large law firm and investigators to come in and continue his fight. In the height of that, I managed my physical pain and my memory problems, my processing issues that I I was recognizing at the time due to the accident with energy drinks. And I do believe my drinking increased. And that was the time when I met my ex-husband. And we met at a political event where I was fighting for the children in Santa Ana. The Tustin Marine Base was closing. Mm-hmm. And we had been locked out of the land, had carried a school bond. And we had legislation that prioritized education over commercial use. He had to decide whether to defend it or not at some point eventually. And I went up and said what the cause was, walked away, and he tracked me down. And I didn't realize that our first date was a date when we had a meeting. Our second date turned into a controlled substance being offered that I now know is the reason that my clothes came off. I take full ownership of that act. I was in a highly, highly disassociated state. And whether or not you think that my ex-husband took advantage of that is your opinion. That didn't get me anywhere in life. The resentment and blaming him for everything that happened after that, what I have learned is that it was my trauma disassociated state and just fighting for everything and anybody and to prove my purpose that I was in when I did take that drug. I was impregnated that same time, and the initial reaction was kind of abandonment on his side. And I just decided, again, I'm going to raise this child on my own. I don't need you. I don't need anybody. And I made that decision. I moved in with my mom and sister. Again, he tracked me down and proposed over the phone. I thought it was the best thing to do. I didn't understand what was happening at the time. Public announcement was made. Many, many people think that the story happened an entirely different way, but that's how it happened. I do not regret that decision. He had told me that he loved me early on. And I now see the survival mode that he was in. I do know that he tried to do the right thing. I do know it was also kind of a public damage, thing on his end, but he gave me the gift of my oldest son, Diego. That was the best thing that ever happened to me, as well as what is later in the book, the next good part about our two other sons. But, you know, at that point, I was very disassociated, but Diego's life in me connected me back to my father's spirit, to that light and that warmth and that truth that I had seen in the near-death car accident. It was like everything made sense. And now I know why I survived. Now I know why I am still alive. This child is meant to be, and I'm going to do anything in my power to be the best mom I can be. That was the goal when I moved up north, and it worked for a little bit. I really escaped in our child when I was feeling lonely. Bill truly, I believe, to this day, loves and is fully in love with all of his children and me. And I escaped in those moments of aloneness and darkness, having left everything that I knew in Southern California to move up north, branded as like the wife of, the young wife of, the gold digger, the all these different names and labels, and no one really knew who I was up north. I escaped into the intimate moments mothering with Diego. And that kept me going until I had a calling for the cause when he started school. I wanted to work again. So what I did is I started working for a local attorney on some of the Catholic priest molestation cases. That led to eventually working for one of my heroes, Nancy O'Malley, the former district attorney in Alameda County, a staunch national hero of victims' rights. She wrote the foreword in the book. I had the honor of working for her and heading up the Alameda County Family Justice Center. And I would say it was, you know, when Diego started preschool through about the age of 8 or 9, so 5, 6 years, where I was managing flashbacks, chronic pain, the triggers that it causes, I began managing alcoholically and preparing myself to and not express those concerns, not express the loneliness, and kind of play a role when Bill came home. The longest time he was ever away from us was maybe 48 hours. I mean, he really, really made an effort to not be from us. He hadn't had a family. He hadn't had a normal life before we came into his life. And so I loved being that role. And Diego and I just like filling that hole in him. And I saw, you know, very much the untreated trauma in him. And so anyways, just this kind of life set in. Yet when I look back, I see how the emotional closeness, the feeling safe and being able, I honestly just did not feel that I could turn to him for any of the struggles that I was going through. It was always kind of a just move on and we'll deal with it, or a kind of talking to his back. There wasn't any real one-on-one emotional intimacy. I felt like my job was to ensure that his needs were attended to, and he could, you know, rest, and that any of my worries would be a burden. A lot of that came from childhood. A lot of that came from just the mode of life that I was in. When I started having severe chronic pain and flashbacks, there were a couple of moments, however, that were interactions with him that were quite startling. One of them was a flashback from childhood from the doctor, and he reacted in a way where it wasn't, where I had shame, where the shame about, it was such a vivid flashback that the first ever in my adult life, ever, from the point of 6 or 5 to the point of, you know, how 38, 36. It was such a vivid flashback that I did not know in that moment what had happened. But at that point, my ex-husband's response was, "You're making me feel bad." And so I thought that what had happened to me was something that made me defective, that made me damaged, that made me unworthy. And the shame that my mind created within just set into stone. And from that moment on, it became very, very difficult for us to have any physical or verbal connection. It just became, I was frightened to death. I just became a robot. So,
yeah. Yeah, I, excuse me. You mentioned the flashbacks. They were flashbacks of the doctor of child abuse or?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was a visual. Yes.
Okay. Had you spoken to anybody about that?
No,
so it was all internal.
I never sought any help or understood anything that had happened.
Yeah. This is kind of a helpful learning moment for our audience that by not talking about it, not processing it, I'm not saying you have to come on a podcast and tell the whole world, but it's important you find a trusted person, ideally a good trauma therapist. And until that's done, triggers can make us revisit these childhood traumas in particular. And you experience the trauma all over again emotionally. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's
absolutely. Yeah. And when there's childhood trauma, there's for me, there were these scenes and places, and like the closet, the office, and that would come back. And other trauma survivors that I interact with or that I help or that have shared with me, I know would stand by me in saying this, that when you are an adult and you know that we call it a flashback, but when you have things come up in your head here and there and you can't quite understand them, the bravest thing you can do is to do what you're saying, is to share it with someone. It can be a therapist, ideally, if we're lucky enough, but it can also be a sibling. It could be a friend. It could be, you know, at your church. It could be in a 12-step fellowship. It's just putting it out in words and that reaching out for help will open a box the human connection will be created, but it'll open a box that demystifies it.
Right.
That gets it out of your head and that, you know, gets it out of this locked state and how our mind is trying to interpret it. And really that's what happened later in my life. But you make such a good point. That yeah, we can reach out to a therapist, but we can also just say, you know what, this thing keeps coming up in my head, and I don't understand why. It can be to anybody.
Yeah,
and is the most courageous thing we can do.
Yeah, and the other thing I would say is, if you're not at a point of telling somebody, journal it, write it down.
Right. Yes,
and you know, have a conversation with yourself. But don't bottle it up inside. That is never a successful strategy long term. It just doesn't happen. And I see it over and over again. And I appreciate your talking about it, because the whole point of this whole thing is to help people.
Right.
And, you know, when in the prison system, you know, you hear guys, you know, they committed horrible crimes. There's no question about it. And they admit it. But the backstory of the horrific childhoods they came from they're just off the scale, you know, of watching their mom pimp their sister out for drug money. I mean, just the ugliest thing you can ever imagine human beings doing.
And who was asking about them and what happened to them.
Yeah.
And why they're responding the way they are with crime. Yeah.
Yeah.
I appreciate that you're seeing them for whole people.
Yeah. And I appreciate your sharing your story, because it just, these conversations help people. It's just that simple. Thanks for letting me kind of interject that conversation a little bit, but go ahead, please, with your story.
Looking back, I can see now what was going on and reflecting back, yet it became such a disconnected and lonely and desperate and dark place in the house, in that shame, unable to even say, like what we were just talking about, this memory came into my head and, or I don't understand this. The level of disassociation was so heightened. At the same time, I had taken my brother in, who had some struggles with his own mental health. And I had a full-time job heading up the Alameda County Family Justice Center, saving others. And the timeline may be a little off, but all of these things were kind of happening at the same time. The disassociation was building. I was saving people and I loved my job I wasn't saving people. The frontliners were saving people. I was helping the frontliners to save people and the physician at the Family Justice Center. I had taken my brother in who had his own struggles. It was probably about 6 months or so, prior to finding out that I was pregnant, that we took my brother in. After that, our child stopped growing in me. My brother, so we lost a child. My brother struggled so much with his own mental health that he ended up attempting to take his life under our roof. I did find him and felt responsible. And around the same time, this was within, maybe 9 months, 10 months, I found out that Arthur Carmona was struck and killed and he had been freed. Mm. He was freed about a year before Diego was born. And so I couldn't keep up. I just couldn't keep up. So in the heightened disassociated state at home, the brother, the child, Arthur, somewhere in me, I had the will to reach out for help. Somewhere in me, I believed in what I had seen and my father's spirit. There was a calling always in me for mm-hmm. the light and the truth and hope. And I reached out as I was running for county supervisor. I knew my drinking had increased. I knew the loneliness was getting so dark and the chronic pain was getting so bad, all manifesting, together. I went to Kaiser for help. And I was getting the help that I needed after I had won the primary. And that was where I met a gentleman that fit and manipulated and defrauded that exact place of need and desperation and depression and darkness that I was in at the time. And that was absolutely the most devastating trauma that I've ever experienced is what that man did to me and my family.
So that's kind of the, correct me if I'm wrong, but all time low. Is that fair?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Separation from my children.
Yeah.
Later, yet I had found some spiritual mending that I will refer to that kept me. Kept me going, but that's a different kind of heartbreak and desperation. Mm-hmm. The psychological and physical abuse. Yes.
Yeah. I have two questions.
Yes.
Where
we were at.
Yeah. The first question I have for you, Nadia, is disassociation. I think I know what you're talking about, but do you mind describing what dissociation is and more importantly, your experience? And then whatever you would like to share about this. I think you're using the term generously, but this gentleman that came along.
Disassociation before I met him?
Well, yeah, you mentioned disassociation a couple times. And so what was that all about? And how would you describe that to someone who isn't familiar with disassociation?
I think that there's levels of it for sure. I mean, I can find myself today in minor disassociated states where I'm aware of it. And I think a lot of people kind of go in and out. Yet this is where I can observe being a little detached, a little, you know, not listening as well enough, or not being able to, maybe my memory isn't going well. Now, those I think people go in and out of all the mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm. At that time, then there was a disassociated state where, for me, then it's. You cannot connect to the people, the room, to really anything that's going on. It's you're in a body walking and playing a role, and time just like is irrelevant and mm-hmm. passes, and you're just trying to get through, you know, any given day.
Yeah.
I have had disassociated states where it is in a different kind of, I mean, a literal mode where it's almost like a different personality. It's mm-hmm. like, okay, now I can see that, but it's almost like, okay, you know, it's kind of like the mom that goes onto the field and is, okay, now I need to, you know, pretend like everything is okay. And, or I have to have it all together. I mean, I do believe that, in the public eye, when you are so alone and so trauma, so scared at home, you can make a choice to mm-hmm. go out and present yourself in a disassociated way, yet come home and cry alone.
Yeah.
So I think there's different types.
I think you're right. And the term disassociation comes up a lot with shock. It's a reaction to shock, where nature is taking you kind of mentally and emotionally away from where reality resides mm-hmm. as kind of a protective measure. Right. And even though the trauma might have happened years ago, even right. decades ago, disassociation is kind of that trauma response where even though the trauma isn't present right now, it was years ago, we're triggered in such a way that the cortisol is secreted, mm-hmm. the adrenaline is secreted, we go into a fight, flight, freeze mode, mm-hmm. and this is disassociated more in the freeze mode where we just freeze up emotionally mm-hmm. In the hopes that the lion chasing us doesn't see us.
Right.
And so there's this disconnect between our reality, which may not encompass any actual trauma, and our mental state, which is reliving this whole trauma response cycle. So that's the best shot I can give at explaining to our listeners what that is all about when you're talking about disassociation.
Yeah, and it's I think that teaching this more and more is so important, because I believe that we're not talking about that emotional kind of awareness with children or out in the world mm-hmm. and that a lot of people do live in different levels of disassociation, and it gets back to that reptilian, you know, survivalist brain. And when we haven't learned as children to put words on feelings, and then bad things happen, and then later in adult life, horrible, more and more things start happening, to get to, you know, a point where you can even find words to be able to say to somebody, look, this is happening right now, mm-hmm. is just not possible. And, you know, anyways, it's a word, but that we use, but the main point of this all is if we're teaching emotional awareness and resilience to children, I think what keeps us in the dark the most is not knowing how our mind works in the survivalist nature, and then how it creates the shame that keeps us right there in the dark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said. So getting back to the guy who kind of, for lack of a better word, infiltrated your life, what more, or if anything, you want to share about that?
The reason why I was saying the stuff before that is that in this very, very dark and shame-based place that I was at, it was disassociated, yet my survivalist mind was creating this shame about what had happened to me. Mm-hmm. And in that state is where this perpetrator, that I will call him, saw this Lockyer family and saw this woman who had reached out for help, me. Mm-hmm. And I did not know that he had had this MO with other women prior. I did not know that he was somebody. So basically, I mean, he sat down on the curb and was, you know, like, well, you know, I get it. I'm here to listen, and, you know, you can cry with me. And I had not had any peer connection since the marriage had happened, any peer, any real, like, one-on-one connection whatsoever with somebody. So he fit right in to this mold. And
so there's kind of an emotional gap that he filled, sounds like.
And Bill was staying in Sacramento quite a bit at that time. And we pretty much decided to separate because the arguments at home were getting so heightened, and a lot of it dealt with, I was afraid, like there was some intimacy desired, and it was creating some tension. Mm-hmm. And so at the time he was in Sacramento, there was a void, and this peer, I had heard about this other person in Bill's life in the past, and all these things in our heads had us in two different places. So yeah, SC fit right into this mold of he gets it. He's a peer. He listens to the same music. I was so lonely and desperate of a peer connection that's what happened. And when Bill and I decided to reconcile, I started pushing that person away and told him we can never be. And at that point is when he called and said, I need you, you know, I'm really, really struggling here. And he brought up an ex-girlfriend that, you know, had broken up. And here in my bleeding heart way, I went to him. And it was in that time where he was saying, you know, he was going to take his life, and then said, you know, I have to use. And he brought out a pipe. And my biggest regret is deciding in that moment, or being so naive in that moment, that I took a hit and I got addicted and to methamphetamine. Mm-hmm. I didn't know it in that moment, yet in that moment, just like it had happened with my ex-husband, my clothes easily came off. There's a lot of women that can relate to this experience, mm-hmm. and we need to be smarter and protect ourselves more, protect our daughters and our sons more from anything like this, because this is what can happen even when you're an adult. And so basically that's what happened. I did not know that he would end up taking a recording and taking photos of our private interactions and would later, months after that, attempt to sell them online when I had some indication that this was happening and there was instability. I cut off ties with him and he began to threaten me in texts with taking his own life, threatening that he would, that I would go viral, that he would expose everything. My ex-husband got, now we just divorced like a month ago. So we happily co-parent. We've been together for how many years? So 20. So it's weird to say my ex-husband, but I guess technically he is. But Bill had gotten something in the mail with a DVD. I was completely unaware of this and was blackmailed and threatened. I received texts that my son was going to be taken, Diego. You know, do you know where Diego is right now? When I would be at work. It just kept going on and on and on and on. And at the time, I had a full-time position. I was a mom. And I had no idea where to go to help. Here I was, a county supervisor, the one that was carrying on the public safety committee, the victims' rights and juvenile justice efforts of the county. Yet I did not know how to get help myself. I didn't understand what was happening. Like I couldn't make sense of it. And I do believe that that was this person's goal.
Yeah, MO or
goal. Yeah. And I don't think he worked alone. It was just so overwhelming.
It sounds like whole different level of predator. I mean,
yes, very much so. It was so overwhelming. And so what I did, basically was I reached out to Bill. Bill would get angry. And in that desperation, Bill called and said, this is kind of the epic assault was really, really, really the most violent, the most psychologically, physically, emotionally harmful thing as an adult that took years to recover from. Bill ended up calling and asking if our bank account had been accessed. It hadn't, yet this person was accessing it. And he said some cruel words in this phone call. I had Diego with me. I didn't feel safe to go home. I ended up getting a separate place to stay in my district. That man was tracking my phone and tracked us down and showed up. And I believed that he was the only person that could help me stop what was happening to me. In those moments, he said, I can make this stop. I believed him. And in the trauma beliefs that I was in, I let him in. And when I saw a core moment of truth in his eyes, I was violently assaulted and strangled, and I don't remember what happened after that point, but I did eventually wake up, and the only person that was there that entire night was a police officer from Newark, and I do believe that in those moments, that was probably my darkest. Mm. Within me. Thereafter, I was led to suicidality by the way that the press covered it.
Before we go there, to go back to the childhood trauma, at this point, had you ever spoken about the childhood trauma with anybody?
No.
So you have, correct me if I'm wrong, you have layered trauma.
Yes.
And at that point, you had never discussed any of it really with any genuine person that had your best interests at heart.
No, never.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about the press.
Yeah. So I, thankfully, Nancy O'Malley and another victims' rights advocate came to my home after the assault. And Bill was there in the home and was there for Diego and I, and was, you know, you could have been killed and you need, you know, let's get you some help and protection. And so Nancy O'Malley was the one who came to the house and a victims' rights specialist, and they helped me get some help. And so I went away, and it was in those moments where I was not allowed access to computers or anything of that sort, yet I somehow got word about how the press had covered everything from one of the other clients, and I managed to be able to look. And when I saw the articles, it had nothing to do with the crimes that were committed against us. And it was drug and sex scandal. And it was devastating. There was one reporter in particular who had been rather obsessed with me during the campaign for supervisor, who somehow had access to photos, posted them in his magazine, that blacked out private parts, kind of made a joke of it. It was those moments where what had got me up and fighting before, the light in my son, that will to, you know, save other people. In that moment, it was tough to find.
Yeah.
It was real tough to find. And I kept stalling. And it was my son. It was my son.
That kept you going.
That stalled. Yeah, I was going to hang my body in bright light. That's pretty harsh for people to hear, but that's where trauma and crime and abuse and the press, that's where shaming can take us. And when we don't, you know, see the whole person and what they've gone through, and just simply make pain a scandal. So, okay, my son, I did not attempt to take my life at the time. What I did is I got out, and the press continued. You know, it was awful. It was just some of the press, you know, they were covering things like from beginning to end. There was one reporter that made it a scandal, but I couldn't get any privacy. So I took my son and took off down, left everything, resigned, and took my son here to family in Southern California.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you.
And I'm rebuilding a life and just getting away.
Yeah. You escaped, basically.
That was said, I needed to get to like the indigenous land and my father spirit and something in me that, again, it was like that home, that light, that truth.
Yeah.
That I had.
So from your childhood to this point where you escaped, if you will, back to Southern California and connected with your father's memory and your home. Mm-hmm. At this point, you still had not talked about the whole array of traumas with a qualified person.
No, I had touched upon it a little bit for the month that I was at Bayside Marin, by the way. They're great.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they wanted me to stay longer. She explained the dyadic abusive relationship. But no, I had barely touched upon.
Yeah.
But no, I had not. I did not dive into any of that.
Yeah.
Ever.
So what advice do you have for a parent to pass on to their kids, the new generation, the grandkids that I have, you know, from all of this? What kind of advice for conversations would you pass along?
For our children?
Yes.
About trauma?
Yeah.
I tell my children all the time that they are not bodies, nor the thoughts their mind makes. In their way, they don't understand what that means. That's an adult thing to say. But I think the most important thing is teaching them to put a name on their feelings.
Mm-hmm.
You can't teach children trauma awareness, but you can help them feel safe with themselves and with others, with their feelings. We don't learn any of this as children. And a lot of the work that I do is in living the work with my children is, you know, our core innocence is always there. It's the essence of the spirit. And I can't, you know, teach them how our mind works, but I can say, look, you have a choice between love or fear and judgment. And your mind is kind of over on this side. It's over here in this fear and judgment. You know, what, pick a feeling.
Yeah.
You have the feeling chart here. You know, what is it? And okay, we're going to get over here to love. Like, it's okay that you're having this feeling right now. It's all right. We're going to get in love. And I mean, ultimately, this is where they can connect to their core innocence. This is where their survival mind is.
Yeah.
So I think it's a whole process.
Mm-hmm.
But identifying feelings can't really happen until there's a name put on it and there's a safety within their own body.
Yeah. And I think I like that. And I think it's important to have real conversations with kids about predators and prey and principles, and also with the necessity to be aware of red flags, be smart, enjoy life, but be smart. Don't be stupid. The realities today of fentanyl, that everything from marijuana to cocaine to meth to diet drugs are laced with fentanyl. Mm-hmm. So don't touch anything off the streets. I mean, we're in California, and most places, I think, around the country now, if you need to get, you know, high, I guess, go to a dispensary. But, you know, the realities of fentanyl that, you know, we've had guests on the podcast who lost children to fentanyl, you know, so just have these real conversations is what I'm saying. And don't expect the school system to do it. And don't expect the church to do it. Don't expect the YMCA to do it or Boy Scouts to do it. You know, I hate to say it, you know, this is embarrassing, but I'm an Eagle Scout. I grew up in Boy Scouts, and they just are on the brink of bankruptcy because of child abuse. That never affected me or anything that I ever saw. And I was a Boy Scout leader later, but I took my Eagle Scout award off the wall, and I think I threw it away. I mean, I was just so disgusted with these organizations that are supposed to be for the benefit of kids that are actually dangerous.
Yeah.
And, but just be real with the kids, you know, and have the kids can handle, I think, a lot more than we give them credit for. Right. And be real, you know, talk about this stuff. So,
yeah. And sometimes I think we overcomplicate it in terms of like, it's just the most powerful times I've had with my sons is getting down to their level. And regardless of what's going on, it's just saying to them, because I have 7-year-old twin boys mm-hmm. and then the 19-year-old. And, you know, it applies with both of them. Diego, my oldest, is able to do this with his little brothers. But sometimes the simplest thing, like if anyone ever hurts you, you know, I believe you. It's just like looking them in the eye and sitting down and being like, name the feeling, you know, I believe you. And creating that space where they can be vulnerable. You know, I've learned the hard way that what we feel vulnerable about is what we feel, what we learn shame about or in ourselves. And so if they're learning to not have shame in or about a feeling, mm-hmm. vulnerability is not a scary thing. So it starts with like looking them in the eye. For me, it starts with looking them in the eye, mm-hmm. putting the name on the feeling, creating that human connection. Then the word predator might understand it, but like then they can say somebody's hurting me. I just feel like creating that human connection and that safe, secure attachment is where the change will happen. From the get-go, from the initial first human interaction as parents that we can have to change the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Nicely said. So to kind of recap, you know, you went through the car wreck. You had the childhood trauma. You recover from the childhood car wreck. You're kind of, or I guess the way I
was an adult. Yeah.
Yeah. As an adult, you're in law school, you know, you're following the path of your dad, who's very prominent in the legal community and society at large. And then you're kind of maneuvered, for lack of a better word, into a marriage. That didn't turn out for what, you know, we all hope for with a healthy marriage. Then a guy comes along, you made a choice to take a hit off meth, you know, I also volunteered at the homeless shelter down here, and there was a beautiful woman there at the homeless shelter who was in a car wreck and, got addicted to meth, wrecked her whole life. And then she's in a homeless shelter. She's rebuilt her life successfully. Mm-hmm. And, right. And yeah, it's phenomenal. But you know, you went through all that. Then you run into a guy who's just evil to the core. Honestly, it sounds like, who manipulated his way into your life, you know, with extortion and just crazy stuff. And then the media comes along and to get ratings and everything else exploits it. One thing about the media is that they can, it's all about ratings. I mean, and whatever's the most scandalous, they often go with it, you know, and they don't care about the damage they do. Sometimes some media is responsible, but, okay. So where do you want to go next with your story?
So the mode that I was in when I met and was eventually exploited, assaulted by this man, was a focus on everything on the outside. Most of us live that way. But here I had just run for county supervisor. My name is on every electrical pole, my face on people's doorsteps. And I believe in my heart, like this is what I am fighting to save the world. Mm-hmm. So I want to, hold the quote unquote press accountable, but this was really one local reporter that kind of twisted it and empowered one man. The media that covered all of the assault and everything else after that, some of them tried to be fair. yet quote unquote fair. Yet one of them actually like empowered him. When the media started covering this assault and this case and everything of the sort, I believe that the branding of the wife of and supposedly this man that she had an affair with, although Bill and I were separated, what was said there and not the digging deeper into the human story and the real human struggles made for the next several years the entire focus of overcoming shame.
Mm-hmm.
So it just seemed that no matter what I did to rebuild my life, professionally, as a mother, in every single way, was extremely, extremely difficult. And so I came down to Southern California. I moved in with my sister, and I ended up going back up to get a whole bunch of other things and for a friend to help me move some additional properties, additional boxes and things of the sort, because I realized that I was in fact going to file for divorce.
In the survival mode, one of the kind of fun aspects is to kind of experiment and try different things out to find kind of what's going to help heal us. What did that look like for you?
So I explained after the assault in Northern California, I came down to my sister and I had a relapse and I landed in jail. Mm. And in that moment, I was in the same spot where I had been how many decades prior as an attorney representing Arthur Carmona, this kid that had been wrongfully convicted. And there I was behind bars, suicidal, being publicly shamed, the furthest from my truth and core worth inside, and desperate. And I had no clue how I got there. I honestly did not understand how the survival mode that I had been in, like the level of pain and the level of shame and the level of truth that was being denied on the outside and that I did not see within me was so deep in those moments there while I was at Santa Ana jail. What happened was Al Stocky, the closest thing to my father, came on that day and he looked me in the eye and he is like, I'm going to help you through this. You can get through this. What I did not know was that it would begin a 10-year journey, like right straight back to my truth and to my father's spirit and to everything that I experienced and saw as truth in that near-death accident and everything today. If I had known it would be that layered prior, I wouldn't have not understood all the blessings and all the different learnings that are combined today and what I do. But that really truly was the pivotal changing moment. I began, so I want to share, I mean, I'm living the work and a lot of stuff that I'll reference throughout that 10, now 11, 12 year journey is stuff that I have had like the blessing of learning that has helped me to survive and then get into the thrive stage. Some of it is 12-step recovery. Some of it is A Course in Miracles work. A lot of it is from references to Kundalini yoga, Eastern teachings. And a lot of it is the trauma recovery tools that I now use every day. Mm-hmm. Yet most of it definitely comes from the mindfulness and the grounding and the more just conscious way of living as a mom that keeps me accountable today mm-hmm. in every single way. So all of that said, back yonder, I first began in a treatment center, a mandated treatment center for a year. This was in, 2013. And yeah, that was needed. That's great. We got to start with physical sobriety. And you know, I don't like it when I say, you know, please forgive me for saying, you know, if that's for how many times that I have said
it. You know, it's okay.
But I went to a treatment center where sobriety was required. That's where you begin. And where I was in a different part of the state, so I somewhat felt physically safe. And where step work and an AA recovery kind of life began. Now, at that time, I was separated from my oldest child, which broke my heart. To this day, I don't understand why there are still not enough options for moms that are struggling with mental health. I mean, chronic pain, for God's sake, mm-hmm. mental health and addiction. I had a will in me to go and get help for any one of those things prior to any of this happening somewhere, especially the chronic pain and mm-hmm. when I started managing with the drinking. But I didn't know where to go, let alone if you're in the public eye. So a part of me felt like I felt I was damaging my son when I was sent away to get help. I felt that it was making all of the situation that much more worse. So while I had physical sobriety, I was eating away with shame as a mom. I was deeply concerned about my child and went about in this, I'm going to approach recovery and sobriety in that same survival fighting mode. Nowhere getting deeper into the issues, nowhere diving deep into the trauma and the real healing work. I would say it was like that for a good couple of years in my initial stages of sobriety or recovery, I should say, healing. When I got Bill moved from Southern California down here, I initially was going to leave him and separate him and have Diego full time. He kind of maneuvered his way back into our living situation. And I had a lot of guilt. I had a lot of step work that I had done where I had had to accept his responses to a lot of things. And so my step work kind of had me in a good place of working through some of this forgiveness and acceptance. We reconciled. I had about a year or so of trying to recreate my professional life. I felt like I kept hitting a wall because of what the stuff online. What, again, I did not know yet up until that point was that what was said and what was done to me was not the truth. And that no matter anything, no matter what anyone has said or done to me, including myself, changed my core worth. I wasn't there yet. So in this mode, I decided to start meditation, to begin somewhat of a yoga practice. I got very active in my 12-step recovery, but I felt a wall in recreating my professional life. In some of that little bit of healing, I began kind of waiting for an answer about what to do next with a higher purpose. I started having thoughts of having more children. I got really active in Diego's school. And it was during that time where I had a dream where it was similar. It was a vision. It wasn't an experience of the near-death accident, but where I had an inclination that I, that we were meant to have more children. So that's what happened. I did not tell Diego. I didn't want him to think anything was lacking. I started volunteering at a lot of domestic violence shelters, got certified as an advocate, and we did not do the traditional way of making a child. We did the lab thing, and I did not expect twins, but that's what happened. And they are amazing blessings that keep me living the work every day, but that's what happened. After they were born, about a year after, the dynamics in the marriage, as well as unaddressed trauma, I had begun some of the therapy work, but I hadn't done the hardcore EMDR. I went to Dee's house it was probably 7 years ago, and met Miriam Paul. And Miriam Paul said to me, this is a year before the twins, she said to me, she said, Nadia, you are not a body nor the thoughts your mind makes. And I was offended. But when she said that to me, that was the beginning of the journey of realizing what my true self was. And I was exposed to Kundalini yoga at the time, and I began learning to feel safe in my body with the breath work. Mm-hmm. And I would say the real, true healing and returning to my true self began at that time.
Cool. How long ago was this?
So, let's see, I went to Dee's house. What is it, 23? So, mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe.
Just guess.
It was like 8 years ago. So, six, seven years ago.
Okay. So, when was the first time, and there's a reason I'm asking this question. When was the very first time you told another qualified person, a trusted person, about the childhood abuse?
It was Kimmy Hunkel, who's in the book. And that was like literally 7 years ago.
Okay.
I had met Kimmy before I went to Dee's house. It could have been longer. Kimmy Hunkel and Dee's house is one of the few. They do not take children, but they do focus on trauma and addiction recovery. Mm-hmm. And it was her.
Okay. See, I'm sorry.
Now, in a little bit more vulnerability, in step work or in treatment, you have to write a timeline. Mm-hmm. That's not telling somebody about trauma. You can write. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And so I don't remember exactly when I first said anything to anybody, but I didn't understand what this place is that my head would go to all the time. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand it.
Well, Yeah, I want to be the first to acknowledge, and I never have claimed to be a therapist because I'm not. I'm a researcher.
We carry it.
And until you open up the wound and clear out that ugly infection and get it out, it's going to fester for decades and decades. Absolutely. I see it over and over and over again. And some people think they're going to cheat the system and keep it a secret. It just doesn't work.
It doesn't work. And, you know, children also, when things have happened to them, the little bursts will kind of come out. So, I mean, I don't know if your child has been bullied and something they repeat, well, remember when so-and-so, or they repeat it more than once, somebody hopefully will sit down with that kid and say, you know, well, what really happened? Tell me more, instead of just brush it off.
Yeah.
Because they will bring it up more than once. If it's not such a bad trauma that was hidden and
repressed
as much as others are, like mine was.
Yeah. I'm with you 100%.
If somebody mentions it, oh my gosh, grab onto that and sit down and ask that kid, tell me more.
Yeah. Probably what, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but probably the conversation that your mom should have had with you when you were a little girl driving home from that, you know, wacko doctor's office.
I don't think she knew. Our parents.
Maybe not. I don't know. I'm not trying to sound judgmental, or maybe I am sounding judgmental. I don't mean to be judgmental. It's okay. But I'm just saying that when we get clues, whether on our own stuff or somebody else's, you know, look at those red flags and talk about them. That's all I'm saying. With the right person.
It's so weird how we just kind of like, it's so interesting how our minds just kind of want to avoid the discomfort, and especially if we're like kind of, if we're the cause. You know, there was a time where, I had to take the kids and just leave the house, and I wasn't allowed. It was, and it broke my heart, and my child was like just ripped out of my hand. And, you know, that was multiple years ago, but it came up. He brought it up. You remember when you were, and it was just, if we had said like, yeah, or, you know, whatever, but there's these golden moments to teach this vulnerability is okay. And say, you know what I do, and I'm so sorry that happened to you. What else do you want to say? Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be something that's that significant or more significant, or just the bully in the bathroom.
And I'm just gonna add one more little
brush them off.
I'm gonna add one more teaching moment. We're gonna come back and jump into thriving, but if you're the person being talked to, the one thing I've done right, and I can point out lots of things I've done badly, but in my career where I'm dealing with trauma, or where I'm dealing with disaster recovery projects coast to coast and around the world on a daily basis.
What you've done that I read. It's
great. Well, it's been a journey, but you know, I meet people, and because of the agreements and the licensing and the professional ethics, I'm not allowed to discuss the stuff I hear, and people know that. And the one thing I've done is I've just sat and listened, and I don't scream and run out of the room. I do keep my mouth shut. And I don't try and fix things because I'm not qualified to. And I say so. But just being a person that people can unload on, and I guess my trauma threshold is pretty high, apparently from the career I've gotten into, I see the sense of relief on people's faces when they've shared with what they've been through. And so if you happen to be that person, that's kind of my I don't know if it's the word's gift, but it's the thing that I kind of do on these projects, because I've had people go through every imaginable thing, from school shootings to rape to murder to mass suicide to terrorist attacks. And you hear some just mind-bending stuff. And if you just sit and listen and not try and fix it, there's no fixing it.
And hold that space.
Yeah. Create a safe space.
Help them feel safe in their body. Sometimes it's just the auric energy is okay right here, right now. It's safe.
Yeah.
Or calm.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's beautiful that you do that for those that have survived such tragic
It's kind of an accident. Yeah, it's an accidental thing I kind of walked into. And I've realized that's why I kind of kept going back to that early trauma, because that unresolved childhood trauma is, and I'm not trying to psychoanalyze you or anyone, but it's oftentimes just that festering infection emotionally.
Randall,
that just doesn't go away.
In my head kept coming back to that space in that room and the closet, everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And
I had understood it like you are saying, or had one person where I don't, what is this? I do believe so much would have been different. I mean, I would have reached out for help. I would have put the names to, I would have just done a little bit more human connection in response to the subsequent pain.
Yeah.
Yeah. The pain that followed thereafter. It would have just been.
Yeah, totally get it.
Yeah,
I totally get it. And I know somebody, and she went through a childhood trauma similar to what you're talking about. And she doesn't tell the world. She tells only a few people, but I happen to have been one of them. But she's very emotionally, her EQ or emotional intelligence is very, very high. And I attribute it to her ability to just tell the truth, you know, as painful as it is. And she's now one of the most solid emotional people I know. And it's because she made at some point in her journey to not carry these deep secrets and cover up for somebody else's horrific behavior. Yeah. So hopefully, you know, this dialogue we're having is helping some people to kind of work through this and look for a thing. But I just want to reiterate, you don't have to tell the world. You don't have to tell anybody. Journal it. Find a trauma therapist. If you can't afford that, there's all kinds of free online stuff. Right in the front of my book, before you get into the book, are a bunch of free 800 numbers. But reach out to somebody and talk to another human being.
Yes.
It's very, very helpful.
And it is that reaching out and that human connection that will start to create the healing, because someone else also will relate to your body language, will relate to, you know, if you can't even find the words, other people can relate by observing and may help you to find the words for it.
You know? Yeah. Completely. So this is a great place to take a break, and we will be back with the Thrive Stage. We're going to talk about all the super cool stuff you're doing and talk about the last 7 years of healing and growth. And I know you got lots of great, you know, things to share. So we're going to come back and talk about that here on Post Traumatic Thriving.
Thanks for supporting our podcast. Be sure to like, share, and subscribe, and follow us on your favorite social media. For books, merchandise, or to donate, visit coreiq.com. Post-Traumatic Thriving is produced by CoreIQ, a nonprofit with a mission to teach the skills we all need but are not taught in school. CoreIQ and the Post-Traumatic Thriving podcast are for informational purposes only and do not provide medical or mental health advice. Always consult with your licensed medical and mental health care providers.